All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about the Texas Rangers on this episode, and that is why I'm wearing my Houston Astros jersey so that no one is confused that we're talking about the Texas Rangers baseball team. No, indeed, we are not. And speaking of Texas Rangers, we've got old Stevie Ray Vaughan on the other end. What's up, dude?
Well, you know, I figured since we're going to be doing a thing on the Texas Rangers, thought I would dress up the part.
There you go.
You like that? What do you think?
Well, here's the thing. Here's my question. The sunglasses are not working. Two, is that your Australian cowboy hat?
No, this is my Tombstone hat. I bought this in Tombstone, Arizona. My Australian hat.
Technically.
What's that?
Technically, that won't work either.
Why?
Because that's out in Arizona.
Now, you know, listen. There was a Chuck Norris movie called Good Men Wear Black. So since Chuck Norris was Walker, Texas Ranger, you know, I think this qualifies.
Yeah, that's a roundabout way to get to the Texas Rangers. Is that a double barrel shotgun?
It is. It is. Short barrel, too. It was my dad's. My dad gave that to me. So, you know. Anyway, but yeah, I figured this is, Texas, you know, Ranger.
Well, from what I can see, it looks like a really nice shotgun. Yeah, I mean, it's in zoom, so it's all pixelated or blurry, so I can't make it out too well, but it looks like a nice looking gun. So while he is disarming himself, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't yet, subscribe to us wherever you're listening, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on. If you don't mind, if you're on YouTube, if you like this video, if you like any of our videos, if you could like it and comment and then also click on the bell, maybe share it as well. All this helps us grow the show, helps us benefit with, you know, the money that comes in, just the overflow of money, which is why you see Alan and I constantly wearing the same clothes throughout the seasons. We can't afford new clothes. Anyways, do us a favor. And if you're on your podcast, rate and review, preferably 5 stars and a glowing review. It is very helpful. And thank you for, listeners for writing the recent reviews. Also, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And yeah, you can find our work, some of our work. When I say our work, it's really my work on The Epoch Times. You can check us out.
You know, I did post something on The Epoch Times. What was it, yesterday, day before, regarding the an article I wrote regarding Texas history, because this is the San Jacinto week when the Battle of San Jacinto took place. So I did add a couple of things in there just to, clarify a few things about what went on during that time period.
Hold on. So you just wrote an article for the Epoch Times?
No. I wrote an article a couple of years ago, and I just...
Oh, you're an idiot. Okay.
How am I an idiot? It's the same story.
I thought that you hadn't written anything in a while.
No, I have not. I told you I
haven't. Yeah, oh man. So you took an article that you wrote a long time ago and posted it on Facebook. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but I added on the post, I did add a few things in there just to kind of, give people an idea, a little bit of a background and whatnot. So,
yeah.
Yes. But, I think it's a very good article. There's no reason to touch it up. Do we retouch the Mona Lisa? I've been to the Louvre twice, and both times I went, Mona Lisa looked exactly the same. I didn't see anything changed. I take that back. I think there was a can of tomato soup that was thrown on it last time.
Yeah. These people are insane. Speaking of insane, I'm out in the Woodlands. There is the Iron Man competition today. God bless those people for doing it. I was talking to somebody just last night. I'm like, I don't know how people do the Ironman competition. One, my right knee is shot. If anybody wants to get in a fight with me, now my weak spot.
Which one?
I don't.
Which one?
Anyways, just rewatch the episode.
All right.
I'm not going to give it away again. Crazy. I wanted to run something by you because last night, a couple of friends of mine hadn't seen John Wick 4. And so I was like, yeah, I'm down to go watch it again. So I went and watched it again last night. There's a preview for a movie that's coming out, I want to say this weekend, called Sisu. And it is about a Finnish military officer who finds gold or whatever, and he ends up, you know, long story short, killing a bunch of Nazis. I remember reading about the Finnish soldiers, especially during the Russian Civil War between the Reds and Whites. Can you give me like just a brief rundown of how more or less badass the Finnish people were during that time, or maybe still are?
Well, you know, Finland, there was no Finland. Russia had annexed it, so they declared their independence when Russia fell apart, when they had the Russian Revolution. So Finland declared its independence, and they were able to, you know, get a sizable amount of land that they wanted. Now, where they really became, and they were, them and the Poles, I don't know if you know about the Poland. Poland, the Russians invaded, or the Soviets invaded up, and they almost captured Warsaw. There was a battle right outside Warsaw, and they managed to push them back and capture quite a bit of land. But in, I think it's November 30 of 1939, under the excuse that Stalin said that the Finns were threatening their existence in, you know, little tiny Finland against big Soviet Union, Stalin decided to invade them, but they got their asses kicked for the longest time. I mean, they, man, it was funny. It was really funny because the Soviets were bad all the time. They just happened to be our allies after Hitler stabbed them in the back. But yeah, Stalin and Hitler were, they, you know, they signed a, they were allies in world at the beginning of World War II, but they fought those Soviets, and it wasn't until the snow thawed out that the Soviets were finally able to win. But they held their own, and then they reinvaded again in 1941 when the Germans attacked.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. Just like you said, very small compared to the Soviet Union.
One of the greatest snipers was a Finn that killed a lot of Soviets, and he ended up getting shot in the jaw. He still, you could, as photos of him, you could see that he still had his face was messed up.
Well, I was telling a friend of mine last night while we were watching the preview, I was like, dude, you need to read into like the Finnish soldiers during that period, during the, you know, post 1917, you know, during the, like the post-revolution, Russian Revolution, and then it going into World War II, like standing up dead, you know, Russian or Soviet soldiers, just like frozen soldiers as like a warning to anyone coming in, like, hey man, this is what's going to happen to you if you keep, you know, pushing in. Really tough people, man. Tougher than me, for sure. I'm not going to say tougher than you.
You know, the temperatures in Finland are, wow, they're pretty cold. I have a friend who lives up there. I could not imagine living in a country where, you know, you're like at the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
Just way too cold. I like Texas heat.
Yeah, I will take the Texas heat over that type of cold. It's too much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have a good time talking to a good friend of ours, Jody Edward Ginn. I'll give you the rundown of who he is. We had him on the show about a year and a half ago, talking about his book, East Texas Troubles, and talking a little bit about the Texas Rangers. But this episode, we're going to really dive into who the Texas Rangers are, where they got their start, and more or less who they have become today, or how, what that organization is today. So Jody Edward Ginn, he is the director of development for the Texas Rangers Hall of Fame and Museum. I believe that's out in Waco. He's the former executive director of the Texas Rangers Heritage Center in Fredericksburg. This is where I got that this mug from while we were out doing our shoot. I'll mention in a second. So he's also a former law enforcement investigator, administrator, and a U.S. Army veteran. He's got 2 decades of experience as a public historian. He's author of The East Texas Troubles. He was also a history consultant on the next Netflix original movie, The Highwaymen, with Kevin Costner and Woody Harrelson, about the Bonnie and Clyde saga, which is a really good movie. If you haven't watched it, you really need to. And lastly, and probably the most important, he made a special guest appearance on our 2-part Eisenhower Nimitz road trip documentary that came out last year. That was probably, I would like to say, the highlight of his career. What do you think, Alan?
Absolutely. You know, and I know also another highlight of his career is when I go to him to ask him questions on which book to read and which ones to avoid. So I know that, you know, when he goes out on dates, that he brings that up very often.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And like,
he goes, yeah, you know those guys on the Sons of History? And, you know, the girls, you know, if they're intelligent, will say, oh, yes, I watch them all the time. Well, you know, I consult for them. Should I have not done a voice, you know, now with the whole Dylan Mulvaney thing, maybe I should do a deeper voice. Because I'm not a biologist, so I can't.
You know?
Although I think Jody wouldn't date a Dylan. Yeah, he would date a Riley. What's that girl's name? The one that what?
The swimmer?
The swimmer, Riley Gaines. That's her name.
Yeah, Riley Gaines. He's a Riley Gaines type of man.
I can see Jody with a Riley Gaines.
Oh, Jody is a man's man. He will shoot your face off and then apologize later. And before he shoots both of our faces off, we're going to bring him
He wouldn't apologize to the person he shot. He'd apologize to the business owner who has to clean up the mess.
Shoot first, apologize later. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Jody Edward Ginn is on the line. We're going to have a good time talking to him. Jody, how you doing, man?
Doing great. How about you guys?
We are doing fantastic.
Yeah, we're doing well as long as we don't bump into things here in our home, but that's another story.
Yes, yes, yeah. If you've got elbows that have minds of their own, it gets a little difficult keeping things in order, as Alan before recording so aptly.
We need lots of funding so that we can get a real studio and have people come and deliver us coffee. And I mean, I got to make my own coffee here. I mean, what kind of a setup is this?
It's not a good setup, but I would rather you yell at yourself about spilling the coffee than yelling at somebody else for spilling coffee on you. So Jody, what have you been up to, man? What's going on?
Well, if you're not aware, this is the 200th anniversary, the bicentennial of the origins of the Texas Rangers. And so I am up to my ears in bicentennial activities and celebrations and articles and interviews and all that sort of thing. Celebrating that, the bicentennial throughout the state over the course of this year.
Wow, congratulations, 200, huh? Now, they're a good baseball team. I've been following them somewhat, but... Wait, you're talking about the Texas Rangers, all right. Hey, Destin, can you remove that?
Yeah, I'll remove that because, one, you got two things wrong at the same time. One, the Rangers, the baseball team, is terrible, although they made some changes during the offseason. And just in case people were curious, this is not Alan's bi-curious celebration. This is the Texas Rangers bicentennial celebration. So, yeah, Alan, no worries. We'll knock that right out. So what's going on with the bicentennial celebration? Like, what all is going on? What are you guys doing?
So there's a group called TexasRanger2023.org. They are the official bicentennial host. They were appointed by the Texas Department of Public Safety to officially represent the Texas Rangers throughout this year and to put on a variety of events and put promotions and so forth, you know, commemorating this you know, historic anniversary. And that's run by a gentleman out of Houston named Russell Molina, the Molina restaurant family out of Houston, one of the, I think, maybe oldest continually operating restaurant in Houston or something like that. Anyhow, he has had put his heart and soul along with his team and managed by Lacey Finley and then also the Texas Ranger Association Foundation. they have raised money and they continue to raise money and to not only to put on these events, but also for some key projects. And the first one, which is almost complete on the fundraising side, is a memorial at the headquarters of DPS in Austin at Lamar Boulevard, where they will have a memorial to all of, not just Rangers, but all of the DPS personnel and Rangers who have been killed in the line of duty throughout history. And so that's a big part of it. And it started with a big kickoff at the Fort Worth Stock Show and Rodeo back in January. Several weeks, you had Texas Ranger bicentennial programs and installations throughout the complex. Every day you had Rangers as a part of the opening. You had honorariums to them. You had the mayor of Fort Worth present a proclamation to the chief of the Rangers, Jason Taylor. Just all sorts of activities and stuff going on. Fort Worth was just incredibly generous to the Rangers in their support and their promotion of the kickoff to the bicentennial. And from there, we're going around the state based on the regions. Now, the Texas Rangers today are organized according to geographical regions in companies called, you know, Company A through Company F. And we're going to each region throughout the year at the headquarters location, in most cases, of the company, and putting on these events. They have a Texas Ranger Day. They have DPS and Ranger, not only personnel, but equipment, everything from helicopters and armored vehicles and weapons and technology, drones, you name it, out there. They have DPS recruiters. You know, if you've thought about a career in law enforcement, if you want to become a Texas Ranger, you got to go through DPS. And so there's DPS recruiters will be at each one of these events, you know, telling you how all of that works and what you need to do to get into that process. And then public events, a community day. That's what a lot of times I'll be presenting at the community days, like I did here in Midland a few weeks ago for Company E. And we have, again, we have personnel from the museum, from the DPS, from other supporting organizations that all come out. We have activities for kids and adults alike. Again, we have Rangers there, you know, vehicles, all that kind of neat stuff to see. And then usually in each location, we'll have a gala if you want to participate in that. That's their big fundraising part of these events. They have these wonderful galas, and they raise money to support these programs, including the emergency fund for Rangers families and scholarships for Rangers kids. And so kind of all of that going on at each company location. So the next one is in Houston at the beginning of May.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember you saying that you're going to be here in May. I think Alan and I reached out to Denton, a mutual friend of ours. I think we're going to try to come down and see you when you are there. Speaking of the Texas Rangers, during our introduction of who you are, obviously we referenced the Highwaymen movie where you were a consultant. There's a little bit of a tie-in where you are right now with that movie. Give us the rundown on the place, man.
Yeah, so if it's looking a little dark and shady where I'm at today, that's because I'm in kind of a dark and shady place. This place, it's been around about for a year, and it's still growing. It's still evolving. But it's a really unique place, and it's the Frank Hamer Speakeasy. And this is a really secret deal. You got to know the password. Don't tell anybody else, but you got to say, I'm here for an appointment with Doc Wilson. And they'll point you upstairs. Or if you're really an insider, you might learn the back entrance up the back stairway. But then you come in and it's a beautiful, just, you know, a bar set up. They've got, you know, themed drinks and with the history, even in the menu, they talk about Frank Hamer history, his connection to the town. You might not know Frank Hamer was once marshal of Navasota for a time in between his stints as a ranger. And he was very respected. There's a statue here in town of him. There's a mural in town with him. And he was friends. His guy who I believe drove for him, if I'm remembering that correctly right now, double check me with the John Bosnecker biography. But Mance Liscom, famous musician, Mance Liscom was from Navasota. And when he was a young man, he spent some time and hung out with and had tremendous respect for Frank Hamer. So they talk about a little bit of all that history. So it's really neat. And even the staff, they know the history and they talk about it to people as they come in. And so it's just such a neat place. Would you like to see a little bit of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of, I think Alan would love going there, and I don't think he'd have any problem getting in. He's always been very familiar with the back entrances.
No, don't go there. Don't go there. I'm used to Navasota. I've been pulled over on Highway 6 on many occasions when I went to A&M, but no, you know, another take that off, take it off.
All right, Jody, give us the quick tour, man.
Jody, before you go on the tour, many of our audience members may not know who Frank Hamer is.
Yeah, Frank Hamer, arguably the most famous Texas Ranger of all time, even before he took down the murderous duo Bonnie and Clyde, for which he became nationally and even internationally famous, and which the Highwayman film that y'all mentioned earlier again was the first film to, you know, broadcast the more accurate story of what happened with all that widely to the world. But yeah, just an incredibly famous and notable Texas Ranger, respected by Rangers and Texans all over. And like I say, that's why there's been movies made about him. And so, but his history with this town, the town has a, you know, a very favorable view of him. And his time here, and they for a long time have kind of decided to, you know, to you know, embrace that part of their history. And so this is kind of the most recent element, is the Frank Hamer speakeasy. And they start out with they have a great little exhibit of these are, you know, replicas of some of his favorite firearms. Right here, you see a Colt single action, like his favorite, very favorite firearm of all time, Old Lucky, which I was asked to broker an opportunity for Kevin Costner to buy Old Lucky after the Highwayman, but I think he got sticker shock when he found out that was going to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's owned by a private collector currently who prefers to remain anonymous. That's his most famous weapon. But, and then of course up here we've got a 30-30 rifle. This is several of the historic pictures of young Frank Hamer, Texas Ranger, show him carrying a rifle identical to this. And so they've got that there. But then when he went after Bonnie and Clyde, he went and picked out a very specific weapon, a 1911 38 Super. And the reason he did this is because Bonnie and Clyde were known for busting their way through roadblocks, attempting to stop and arrest them, and shooting their way through and driving through. And so they knew they'd need to be able to pierce metal. And the 38 Super is a hot and small round that can pierce metal. And so that's why Hamer particularly went and bought this weapon at that time, which was a cutting edge weapon in the 1934. And so so they have that. And then, of course, back here, they've got this is the back end of the room. The little closet there in the back is where they were running their bar out of. But, you know, you see lots of nice, comfortable seating, dim lighting. You know, nobody can see who you are. You know, you're a nice, nice, low-key place. And, you know, you can hang out and then come back around to the front side. This is where they're putting in a full bar right now. And up over there, they do have a great portrait, but it's in storage at the moment because they're finishing this. They'll have a portrait of Frank himself, the picture of the ambush team with Manny Gault and all the other officers that were involved in taking down Bonnie and Clyde, and some other historic photos and pictures will be up there. And then, of course, you can come out here to the front, and they've got, you know, more and more seating. They've got some musical lamps and decorations here. But the important part is they do have some history books, including the modern biography of Frank Hamer, available to thumb through while you're having a drink, sipping one of their historically themed drinks. One of their neat elements here is this, they still have it's a working elevator, but you can sit on it. They've got it all fixed up so you can sit in the elevator and have a drink, or you can go out onto the Frank Hamer Let's see if I can get this open. Yeah, the balcony out on rail, look over Railroad Street here in historic Navasota, and have your drink on the balcony if you like. But of course, that's going to be a little bit more public. You're kind of giving yourself away if you come out here. So, but last of all, they have, you know, no Frank Hamer speakeasy would be complete without the four. Excuse me. No Frank Hamer speakeasy would be complete without the four whitetail bucks of the apocalypse. I don't ask. I thought you had to see these.
Well, it's different than the four horsemen, I assume.
Yes. Yeah, that's my attempt at real humor.
That's quite a revelation. Oh, it's better than your comment about the back end. The buck end. Did we lose Jody?
All right, can y'all hear me again?
There you are.
All right, now we're back. Okay.
What did you think of that book that you flashed? Because
yeah, it's the modern biography of Frank Hamer. It's called The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, The Man Who Killed Bonnie and Clyde. Or it's all, you know, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, Texas Ranger. They kind of have all that. That's your publisher's, you know, marketing thing. Very long title. But it's by a gentleman named John Bosnecker, a retired attorney out of California, who did do a very commendable job on research.
I wanted to mention, I do have your book, East Texas Troubles. Very good book. But you are always someone that I have turned to in the past. I would say, hey, there's a book on such and such, such event, whether it's a Texas Ranger or whatnot. And I've gotten thumbs up and thumbs down from you. So I know I'm going to forget, but since we're on the topic, a book on what's the best book on the Texas Rangers that's accurate, that's not something that like a wokist would enjoy?
Well, it depends on what you're. If you're looking for a broad general history, the leading modern scholarship is Robert M. Utley's Lone Star Justice and Lone Star Lawman. It's a two-volume series from Oxford University Press, published in 2001 and 2007. Those are your leading kind of, that's a big general history. But the great thing, one of the greatest contributions that Bob Utley made to Texas Ranger scholarship is those books kicked off a renaissance, a return to new research and new scholarship on so many topics in Ranger history. And so there's a lot of good stuff out there these days. One of the best, most recent books is the modern biography of Ranger Captain Will Wright. Now, Will Wright and his family have as strong and as long a Ranger service legacy as anybody out there. He's descended from the Tumlinsons, who were some of the first proto Rangers under in Stephen F. Austin's colony. And then Wright himself is the only person to have served in three iterations of the Rangers. He served in the Frontier Battalion, which was from 1874 to 1901. Then he served in the Ranger Force, which was from 1901 to 1935. And then he served for several years in the end in the Department of Public Safety, Texas Rangers, from 1935 to, I think, from 1935 until 1939.
Robert Utley, he's the guy who wrote the foreword to your book. But I'm actually reading one of his books right now. It's called High Noon at Lincoln, about the Billy the Kid and the Lincoln County War. But I also have I know we mentioned before Ranger Ray Martinez, the guy that took out the Texas. University of Texas sniper, the Texas Tower sniper. I met him a couple of times, and I have two of his books, and I think one of them is about the Rangers.
Yeah, one of his books is about his career in law enforcement, including his time as a Ranger, and the other one is more of a general about law enforcement work and that sort of thing. It's not strictly a history book in it and so forth. But yes, he did publish two books. Yeah, Ray, incredible guy, nicest guy you ever met. You know, he texted me yesterday. He's still going strong, and you know, just one of the nicest people you'll ever meet, as well as being just a legendary figure in modern Texas history.
Yeah, it turns out I went to high school with his niece. I didn't realize it until I showed a photo of the two of us, and one of my former high school team classmates said, "Yeah, that's my uncle." And I was "Oh, wow." Should have seen it coming. Her last name was Martinez, but that's...
Idiot. They're a big family in Texas, and a proud Texas family.
That's right. Hey, you know, I'm thinking probably our listeners are like, wait a minute. You're celebrating the bicentennial. That's 200 years ago. That's 1823. That's, you know, more than a decade before the Texas Revolution breaks out. How are the Texas Rangers established in 1823? Can you explain that?
That is a very fair question. And it's been a question that has been debated, you know, for many, many years, certainly since the second half of the 21st century of scholarship on the Rangers. And so the history of the Rangers is a story of evolution. They have were created and have evolved to be what, you know, Texas has needed in a given time. And, it dates back even before 1823, to tell you the truth. The whole foundation, what made Texas Rangers unique in the early 19th century, is that they were mounted warriors, that they actually learned to not only ride into combat, but to fight from horseback. And that was unique, but they didn't figure that out all on their own. There was a type of soldiers of force that was developed on the Spanish frontier starting back in the 1680s and 1690s, called the Compañías Volantes, the flying companies. And those units basically, they realized that the Spanish leaders came to realize after the Pueblo Revolt that, you know, indigenous peoples did not fight like Europeans. They didn't line up in a battlefield and come at each other and all that. They were more of a raiding culture. And many of them had, of course, adopted the horse, you know, by this time, and had become expert riders and fought from horseback. And so the Spanish leaders realized, like, hey, this is what we're going to have to do if we want to be able to control and defeat these enemies. You know, we can't just, you know, build forts and stuff. We need to get on our horses. We need to pursue and strike. They created a combat doctrine called perseguir y batir, pursue and strike. So by the time that Stephen F. Austin's American settlers that were invited in by first the Spanish government and then the independent confirmed the Austin's contracts, the independent Mexican government, those people start coming in. Well, the Tejanos, as we call them, refer to them now, the Hispanic longtime occupants of Texas, they started teaching these tactics to their Anglo neighbors, their new Anglo neighbors. And it was an evolutionary process. A lot of them came from the East. They weren't used to fighting from horseback and kind of had to be reminded. But over time, because in 1823, the governor of Texas, Felix Tres Palacios, had written instructions about how to set up flying companies in the Anglo colonies. And when Austin gets back from securing his contract, he sees this letter and he's responding and he's wanting to kind of, some of these units were already in play. They were already working. They were already patrolling and ranging, but nobody had used that term yet, you know. And when Austin is writing back to the governor asking for more instructions and asking for permission to kind of expand the operations, he refers to it. He kind of connects when he's reading the instructions of how they're supposed to operate. He's like, well, that sounds like, you know, Rangers like we have in the Northeast. Now, of course, the Rangers in the American colonies and so forth were not, they didn't fight from horseback. Most of them didn't even ride horseback, but they did range through the countryside. They did patrol around, engaging guerrilla scouting activities and guerrilla warfare when they met enemies and that sort of thing. And so that's what he recognized, the connections between this new Spanish tradition on the Texas frontier and the, of course the ranging tradition, so that he uses that word on a letter in 1823. And hence we have the traditional origins of the Texas Rangers.
Well, okay. Now I'm going to get a little technical here. My reading history, a dragoon is a horseman that does not fight typically on horseback. They dismount and then they fight. Whereas a cavalry, they fight on horse. So were they, and tell me if I'm wrong on that one. I'm basing it on secondhand accounts. But were the Rangers, were they more like dragoons or were they more like cavalry?
I think that you know, it depended on which ones you were dealing with and at which time. Even there's even documentation of Austin telling them, hey, stop, you know, building forts, stop getting off of your horse. You know, stay on your horse, pursue these folks. You know, you got to fight from horseback. Now, that wasn't easy to do, though, remember, in this time, because you're talking about people with one single shot black powder weapons. You know, they're Kentucky long rifles, which they're used to. It's like they were great with those Kentucky long rifles if they could get down off there, get behind a tree or a rock or something, and they could aim and fire, and then they could reload from a position of cover. But you can't do that on a horse. And so that's why the legend of Jack Hayes so grew, because during the Republic, he gets a hold of those first Patterson Colt revolvers, those five shooters, and he hands those out. And next thing you know, instead of having to reload after every shot, or maybe they could carry a rifle and two single shot pistols, so maybe they get three shots off. Well, now they can get 10 shots off plus their rifle, plus maybe another gun and that sort of thing. And so that's why you get the legend. And that's where they really start gaining the edge on the Comanches and so forth, who had definitely been dominant up to that point for those reasons we just discussed about, you know, the limitations of the firearms at the time.
Well, I know Spanish soldiers, or even Mexico, they would use spikes or I want to say either lances or lancers. I don't remember which one.
Lancer.
Okay. So was that not something that they could adopt?
Well, yeah. I mean, and some of the early Spanish were using a variety of unique weapons, again, based on what was available, the technology of their time. But like I said, when Rangers gained their fame nationally and internationally, especially with the U.S.-Mexican War, by that point, they've got the revolvers. And like I say, and that gave them the upper edge. I mean, this was just a dramatic leap in firearms technology. But, certainly, I'm sure that they employed, you know, what they had available with them prior to that. But generally, it's like, what can you carry on a horse?
Now, I wanted to ask you, because I keep seeing this on the internet. I see it on the Texas Monthly. I wanted to mention this before we moved on to some of the other subjects. Bass Reeves. I keep seeing that Bass Reeves may have been the Lone Ranger. Everything I've read has nothing to do with him, but what I'm seeing is that folks are regurgitating the same information from one source. You're the expert. Tell us what you think of all that.
Well, I would say I'm not the expert on that, but I am, being a professional, I know how to evaluate scholarship and evidence. And I will say that, and I have paid close attention to this issue and have reviewed it thoroughly. The expert on this subject is Martin Grams. And boy, if you could get him on your show at some point, that would be really, really neat. He's a mutual Facebook friend, so you can find him. We could put y'all together. But he wrote a white paper originally and then later published a book that addresses this. And it's based on evidence. The guy who has been promoting the theory, and that's all it is, the theory that he could have been the most, it's simply based on, well, you know, a lot of things about his career, you know, are similar to some of the stories that they had the Lone Ranger do, you know, some of the, you know, types of activities and stuff. But that's true of so many people of that, so many lawmen of that era. So that, you know, even on that grounds, it doesn't hold. But the bottom line is the evidence exists. The evidence of the creators of the show, the creators of the Lone Ranger. One of them lived in Chicago and one of them lived in New York. So they communicated via mail, you know, back in the early 20th century, written. So the written letters between these men still exist. And they plot out exactly what their motivation was and what the origins were. And basically, in a nutshell, it was a blend between the Tom Mix cowboy character of the period and Robin Hood. That was their creative muse for what became the Lone Ranger. And then the best, like I say, from theirs is, you know, Martin Graham's. It's available online. The white paper is available online. You search Martin Graham's, you search, you know, about Bass Reeves and Lone Ranger, it comes up. It's in a digital document that you can download and share. But there's also a book on you know, that you can get on Amazon or elsewhere by Martin Graham's that addresses all this in great detail.
Yeah, I mean, I do want to know the history of Bass Reeves because I heard that he really was an incredible man. But I want something that's the truth, not just not a myth.
That's my biggest thing about it is I think all this discussion about the Lone Ranger takes away from the man's real and incredibly impressive legacy. So what if it wasn't he was incredible and impressive. And I'm glad that the Yellowstone fella is doing a show about Bass Reeves. I think that's fantastic about his actual life and actions. That's what happened.
Taylor Sheridan is writing, a piece on Bass Reeves, doing a show on him. Oh, then that's going to be fantastic because Taylor Sheridan, I think, is batting 1,000 right now.
Yeah. Well, but you know, I don't. The one thing I don't like on any type of history show or documentary is where, you know, the myth becomes the truth. You know, like I asked Dr. Stephen Hardin. I said, you know, did William Travis, you know, create that, you know, draw a line in the sand? And before I could even finish the question, he looked at me, he goes, no.
Yeah.
I was like, okay.
I have been on panels with Steve where he has addressed that at length, and nobody better than him.
Yeah. But, you know, like with all the stuff that's being rewritten nowadays or, you know, portraying his, you know, historical figures, you know, Cleopatra or Anne Boleyn are now black. Okay, wow. I didn't realize that was. I was like, you know, there are plenty of people that we can talk about in history, but you know,
especially when you're talking about Hollywood. I mean, and I had this, and I hope they don't mind me talking about it. When we were in car service from the airport to the hotel in Denver to go have a private screening for Travis Hamer and his family of the Highwaymen prior to it, you know, releasing publicly, I had this sort of conversation with John Lee Hancock and John Fusco. Now, these are two men at the top of Hollywood and amazing filmmakers and especially amazing writers and period film. And even what they make, they'll be the first to acknowledge you, is not strictly historical. And one of the biggest reasons, it's just not possible. It's not a documentary. There's so many elements, and you know, and we can have that discussion if y'all want about why. But the bottom line is that, you know, you can't be strictly. But they acknowledged that, you know, my inquiry, that the bottom line is that while they, as two individual, you know, writer, director, producers, they have a particular affinity for trying to be true to history. I mean, the whole reason John Fusco wrote The Highwaymen was to correct the myths and false, you know, portrayal of Frank Hamer by the 1967 film. So, but they said that interest in actual history is pretty unique in Hollywood. There's most just really don't care. They'll you know, quote unquote, use history to whatever degree it feeds their creative process, but they feel no obligation to you know, accuracy in the end.
Yeah, there's a, speaking of like rewriting history, obviously, pretty much every institution has come under attack, including the Texas Rangers. I want to, the DPS website about the Texas Rangers, their history, it states that four events talks about four events. The Mexican Revolution, World War One, oil booms, and Prohibition made demands on the Texas Rangers that they couldn't meet. What made these four eras so difficult for the Texas Rangers? And also, go ahead and if this is like specifically the Mexican Revolution, if this is part of that attempt to rewrite the history of the Rangers, or try to more or less just blemish the Rangers and just in general. Not saying that like any other organization is perfect by no means, but if you can, if you want to set the record straight on a few things, but also address those four eras.
Well, first of all, they're not four separate eras. They're four dynamics that are coinciding that feed into what you're saying, to just make for an impossible law enforcement situation in Texas at the time. And you got to remember back then, now we have 170 Rangers for 30 million people. Back then we had maybe 30 on average. I mean, there were usually not more than a dozen along the border from El Paso, you know, at their peak, maybe two dozen. Now, some people will claim, oh no, there were many more, but that's not accurate because they're talking about special Rangers and they're talking about loyalty Rangers, who were two totally different legal and administrative animals and did not answer to the Ranger command at all. You had far more, you know, local law enforcement, federal agents, customs agents, later Border Patrol, in U.S. Army. And so, the idea that every event, every arrest, every killing, whether justified or not, involved Texas Rangers just doesn't even add up in the odds. You know, it's there just weren't enough of them to go around. And so and a part of it, and I write about this in my chapter, Texas Rangers and Myth and Memory, in the book Texan Identities from UNT Press, that we're, you know, I talk about that a big confusion becomes with the term Rinches too, which modern writers have misinterpreted as to meaning specifically and exclusively Texas Rangers, when in fact, even Américo Paredes, back as early as the 1950s, specifically stated that a Rinches was a term that referred to basically anybody on a horse with a gun and maybe a badge, and that was basically in conflict with, regional peoples, especially people like revolutionaries or tiquereros or other, you know, people trying to smuggle contraband, commit crimes, and anybody who tried to stop them was a Rinche. So, like I say, the odds that all of those accounts refer to Rangers is just it's numerically impossible. It's statistically impossible.
Well, we know that was at Love Field there. They, I don't know if they tried to or if they successfully removed the statue of the Rangers in Dallas's Love Field. I know there was a controversy. Now, during Dustin mentioned the Revolutionary War and World War One. During that time, Pancho Villa was launching raids into Texas, New Mexico, and during that time, there was
not Texas to New Mexico.
No, I thought they raided in Texas also. Pancho Villa? I was just in
the Carranzistas, absolutely.
Okay, well, I know about Columbus, New Mexico. That was Mexico. Okay, but the ones in Texas now, but that was part of the Mexican Revolution, but it wasn't Pancho.
A lot of factions in the Mexican Revolution. Uh-huh.
Okay, all right. Thank you for correcting me on that. So, now I do know, and the reason why I'm mentioning this is because there has been a lot of discussions regarding an incident where I think a dozen or so Mexican Americans were killed or executed during that time, and I think it was because in response of an incident that took place, which I am under the assumption this is one of the reasons why they are trying to erase the Texas Rangers as something good that if you want to address that, because I know people will always bring this up. I mean, what I don't know enough about it. What's the story on what happened?
Talk about the history. And I think the event you're referring to is the Porvenir Massacre.
Yes, yeah, it begins with the P.
Yeah, the Porvenir Massacre, an awful event, an indefensible event in Texas history that's been written about. Walter Prescott Webb in 1935 included that in his book. And there have been books dealing with it, especially since the 1960s, you know, basically every 2 to 5 years on average. So it's a well documented, well covered. There's been even some recent documentaries, some archaeological work, that sort of thing. And there is no defending the events that happened. Now, there's a lot of details of those events, starting with what you alluded to about that the Porvenir events were in response to and arguably a retaliation for a raid on the Bright Ranch just days before. Okay. And so there's that. And then in the days after, members and relatives of the Porvenir victims then raided another ranch and killed not only a white person, but a Hispanic family that worked there and brutally mutilated the woman. Since this is a family show, I mean, we'll just leave it at that. And I think that's a perfect example of this was a time and a period of constant guerrilla warfare back and forth across the border, combined with crime, just general, you know, criminals taking advantage of the instability and the chaos. And so it was awful. And there was atrocities, by those Rangers in that case. There's atrocities by Mexican nationals, by Texas Hispanics, you name it. It was an awful time, and nobody that I know has ever tried to defend or make excuses for Porvenir. It is what it is. And the other thing with it was a bunch of rookies, and their commander let them go out without them, and they were with a unit of the military. And there's a lot of questions that remain that I don't think we'll ever have the answers to about what exactly was the military's role versus the Rangers role. They both kind of pointed the fingers at each other in the aftermath. And I just don't think we'll ever know the full truth of some of that. And as historians, we have to be able to be honest and say when we just don't know, when we just can't prove. And this is just one of those cases, about who exactly all was involved in all of that. But and that's why the guys, some of them quit and the rest got fired, and the commander, because he sent them out without leadership, got fired. Now he was brought back several years later by the corrupt governor, Paul Ferguson, Farmer Jim Ferguson. And then, of course, when Jim went out of office, then he was gone again. And that was the problem. That's what Bob Utley talks about, is that during this era, the Rangers were being politicized. And Ranger appointments were being used as political capital and political patronage. And so it totally depended to some on who the governor was and the quality of that governor as to the quality of the Rangers. So sometimes there were some very awful Rangers. Sometimes they ran out really respected Rangers like John Hughes. Paul Ferguson did that. He fires John Hughes and he brings in a killer. I'm going to blank on his name now. It starts with an H. But there were people that were appointed as Rangers who had no business being Rangers and either did nothing, which is what led to the crime spree of Bonnie and Clyde and the takeover of San Augustine in East Texas, or they were even worse. They were committing crimes themselves, including and up to murder. So it's a very complicated and sometimes ugly time in Texas history. The main thing is, you know, we need to recognize it in its full context.
Okay. So, all right. Because, like I said, I didn't know the details, but I remember reading about it. There was nothing mentioned of the events that were going on, all the other events that were taking place along the border, the raids from Mexico, but I did I remember watching The Highwaymen, and Ma Ferguson, played by Kathy Bates, seemed to not like the Rangers. And I got the impression that the Rangers weren't even in operation during that time. But it didn't really do a backstory on that. So I didn't know if that had something to do with it, or was it?
It does have something to do with it. You're absolutely right. Now, that is one of those areas where John Fusco had to kind of, play with the history and kind of merge some things together and simplify, distill some things down, because he couldn't get off track. I mean, this story was about Frank Hamer and his pursuit of Bonnie and Clyde. And so he can't kind of get off into all the side tangents too far about what's going on with the Rangers at large, though he does hint at it very well. And while no, the Rangers were never disbanded like they imply in the movie, they were in fact diminished in their public perception, to the point that, and as you read in East Texas Troubles, that people of the time very clearly distinguished between Ferguson Rangers and All Red Rangers, and in Ferguson Rangers and other Rangers. And that's why his use of Ferguson agents, actually, even though it's not to the detail accurate, it rings historically true and authentic that they were a different species from the Rangers of before her time. And absolutely, the Fergusons and the respected Rangers despised each other. And that's why Frank Hamer quit in 1933, when she was reelected that last time, and so forth. So, yeah.
So how did the Texas Rangers become the detective agency that it is today?
So again, that was an evolution. That's a great question. That's part of the evolution. So in the beginning, they're frontier, as I described, mounted frontier defenders. They're military guys, and they're fighting battles. They're not law enforcement. There's some stuff out there over time that has kind of lumped that together, especially because some of them, even the ones like Jack Hazig, becomes sheriff in California. So they seem to think, oh, well, that means he was law enforcement before. Well, no. When he was a Ranger, he was not law enforcement. He was a military commander. And so, but in 1874, after Reconstruction, and they come back in, and the Texas government forms the Texas Rangers for the first time into a permanent, because up to the 1874, they've been a volunteer militia type setup. They weren't a standing force. Well, in 1874, they become a standing force, the Frontier Battalion, and even the Washington unit under McNally, which there was debate in years past of whether, about them as well as far as Ranger status. But most now recognize they too were ranging units, and they were kind of engaged more in law enforcement than the Frontier Battalion was at first. And so what happened was the Frontier Battalion in particular was given, it said the law that created the Frontier Battalion said that officers of the Rangers could make arrests. And shortly after they were created, you have the Red River War, and the frontier is effectively closed, and the final Comanches Quanah Parker and all they resign themselves to the reservations in what's now Oklahoma. And so there's not a lot for these Frontier Battalion guys to do while they're patrolling the frontier. And so they start getting involved with fugitive apprehension, because where do people who commit serious crimes go to escape arrest? They go out into the frontier, and the city marshals and sheriffs and stuff don't have the manpower and the time to go searching the frontier for these people. So there was a book that was created a list of fugitives and their descriptions and this sort of things. And the Rangers started carrying this little black book of fugitives and started keeping an eye out for them and catching them and that sort of thing. And so that's kind of how they start getting into a kind of semi law enforcement role. And then again, as time goes on and there's less and less frontier defending, and they start getting involved in dealing with feuds and that sort of thing, like the John Wesley Hardin and all of that. And then they start pursuing them. And so it just evolves. But in 1901, by 1901, there's been a lot of problems because of the wording saying officer, and the Rangers haven't been a military group. And in military parlance, officer is lieutenant and above. It's not private and sergeant and all of that. And so in the ranks of the Rangers started out at the time private, and then sometimes corporals, and then sergeants and so forth. And so lawyers start picking up on this and start threatening, not only defending against, saying, you know, you got to throw out this arrest in this case because it was an illegal arrest, but even threatening to file criminal charges against the Rangers for making these arrests unlawfully if there wasn't an officer present. And in order to settle all those issues, and you know, long and the short of it was, they do away with repeal the Frontier Battalion statute, and they create the Ranger Force. And in the Ranger Force statute, they say, okay, all Rangers have powers of arrest and have powers of a peace officer. And that's when they really become a full peace officer. And then in 1935, because of all the troubles we already discussed with the corruption and the political abuse and stuff, in 1935, the Department of Public Safety is created. And there's some question about what the Rangers' role is going to be. And even people like Walter Webb predicted, oh, the Rangers, you know, are not long left. They're going to disappear. We're not going to have them anymore. But in fact, he couldn't have been more wrong, because they started on this process. And that's during the 1930s and 40s and 50s and 60s. They start, you know, honing in and evolving and expanding their work as investigators, and, you know, to become the elite investigators we know today.
So they're akin to a Texas version of the FBI then, because
they probably not prefer that, but you're right. They are the elite investigative arm for the state, and arguably more famous, or at least equally famous, and given that that's a national agency with thousands of people and they're a state agency with 170, that's quite a call. They certainly are more famous than any of their other state counterparts.
Hey, my last question, Jody, what is the high point? What would you say is the high point of the Texas Rangers? Would you say it's the Bonnie and Clyde saga, or is that simply just the most famous one?
Yeah. And the problem is they weren't Rangers at the time. You know, they had left the Rangers. They weren't Rangers. Hamer himself was carrying a commission. He was actually carrying three commissions altogether. This is something that I have and will be publishing on that even Mr. Bossenecker missed, that he actually was, because there's been a lot of debate about how he was commissioned. And the reason was he actually was carrying three. He had a commission from a district court, which had warrants for Bonnie and Clyde. He had a commission from the Highway Patrol, which he had had since he left the Rangers. And he was basically doing kind of bounty hunting type work for fugitives, and had actually been kind of watching the Bonnie and Clyde situation for some time, even before he was asked to come on. And then he was carrying a commission after the Huntsville breakout that the movie starts with. You know, Lee Simmons, you know, asked the governor's permission to hire him, and he's commissioned as a special investigator by the prison system. And then Manny Gault, who actually didn't come on until later, his character in the movie is a composite of several different officers and agents. But he came on after the Grapevine shooting, because the Highway Patrol director asked, hey, can we get one of our guys? And Hamer saying, well, I'll take Manny Gault, because Manny was working for the Highway Patrol. And so that's how he was commissioned.
So I guess on a technicality, that can't be the high point of the Texas Rangers. So what would you say is, would it be today?
Well, yeah, I think a lot, there's been a lot in the modern area I would say, because of the professionalism, because of the extensive training and experience that the modern Ranger has, because it's the increasing diversity. You know, we have women Rangers, we have Rangers that represent, you know, every you know, Texan, that sort of thing. And so yeah, a lot of high points in the modern era. But like with anything, it's, you know, there's ups and downs, there's goods and bads. Some things, situations go better than others. People make mistakes. You know, the biggest thing that impresses me, knowing Texas Rangers and knowing what the job they do, is that they are human beings, and people have to remember that. Just like all law enforcement officers, just like all, they're human beings, like all the rest of us, and they do. Carolina Castillo Krim, you know, said it so well. Dr. Carolina Castillo Krim, when we was interviewing her some years ago, you know, They're human beings that are faced often with impossible tasks, and they see them through. And so, yeah.
Well, Jody, this has been a fantastic conversation.
Before he leaves,
Alan has no other questions.
I'd have a question.
He's done for the evening.
Zip it. Real quick, tell the audience where the Texas Ranger Museum, their website.
Oh, yeah. TexasRangers.org. And then if you want to know about the bicentennial events, go to TexasRanger2023.org. And there's a calendar on there. Find the events that are near you or nearest you that are coming up throughout the rest of the year.
All right. And you're going to be in town early May. Where are you going to be, just in case some of our fellow Houstonians want to come out there?
We're going to be at the DPS headquarters one day for the Ranger Day. We're going to be, I can't remember if there or another location for Community Day, but that's on the calendar. And then we'll be at the Armadillo. What's it called? The Armadillo. It's the part of the barbecue family down there off of 59.
Well, there you go. All right. Well, Jody, thanks for joining us. And you said you're working on a new book. Do you have a timeline on when that might be out?
Boy, that's tough with the full-time job and all that, you know, I just don't, but yeah, I'm working on a book that focuses on the stories of the victims of Bonnie and Clyde. And that's not just the people they murdered, but that's also the families that were decimated by those murders and the generational impact and the popular media coverage, how the media has often romanticized Bonnie and Clyde and how that has re-victimized these families as well over time.
Well, all right, man. Well, thanks again for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
I'm looking forward to it, fellas. Thanks again.
Thank you, Jody. Always good talking to you and chatting with you.
Yep, same here. I really appreciate it, fellas. Good to see y'all.
All right, now that we're done with Jody, I can put this thing back on because I didn't want to look like an idiot in front of him. So I should have asked him if this is a hat that worthy of a Texas Ranger. You know, I told you I bought this in Tombstone on Allen Street, so therefore it qualifies. But yeah, as usual, man, love talking to Jody. He's a good sport. He's intelligent. He knows his stuff. I was about to say something else. He knows his, you know, but again, we're a family show.
Family show.
But yeah, I always love talking to him. I always like to get his opinion. You know, I go to him quite often. I've gone to him in regards to the Bass Reeves story, not the Dustin Bass, but the Bass Reeves. And you know, I've asked him on numerous occasions about books, what books he recommends, and he'll flat out say, "Don't get this book because it's full of crap." But he's also, you know, when he came out and joined us in Fredericksburg, he's a fun dude. And. And I'm looking forward to seeing him in a couple weeks. What'd you think?
Yeah, it's always good to talk to him. He is a very upfront and honest historian. Like, he does not, for the lack of a better term, pussyfoot around. Like, he's just like, look, this is what it is. This is how it is. And I really appreciate that. Like, there is no second guessing. When it comes to talking, for me at least, when it comes to talking to him, there's no second guessing like his motives behind anything. He's just, he's very straightforward. And I appreciate that, not just in a person, but especially in a historian. So it's always good to talk to him. And he's just a freaking wealth of knowledge. And he seemingly knows everybody. The first time we met him was when we put on our Texas History event. I want to say 2 years ago, with Denton Florian and Dr. Stephen Harden, and he showed up, and you know, you and I and Stephen and Jody went and grabbed a few drinks, and just really hit it off, and we connected from there. But you know, he was like, "Oh yeah, I know that guy, and I know this guy, and oh yeah, yeah, you need to really connect with, you know, such and such." I was like, "Oh my gosh!" So yeah, he's. He's a wealth of information. He's very well connected, especially in the Texas history sector. So it's good to have him as a friend.
Well, because I had asked him if he knew Ranger Ray Martinez, and yeah, they happen to know each other. And in fact, I spoke to Ranger Ray on the phone not too long ago. He's gotten up in age. I mean, this guy, this is the one that him and another cop. I want to say his name. The other cop's name was Houston. I hope I got that one right. I'm not exactly sure. Someone named Houston went up in the tower. There are three of them, two cops and a civilian. And they managed to kill the sniper, Charles Whitman. But yeah, he knows him. Ranger Ray had a lot of good things to say about Jody. But, you know, I always wanted to address the events of what took place during the Mexican Revolution when there was the Pancho Villa. And I thought Pancho Villa had attacked throughout Texas. But yeah, he said, no, it was only that one time in New Mexico, in Columbus. But all the other incidents that took place along the border, the Texas-Mexican border. And the reason why I wanted to bring this up is because you and I, we've had complaints about agendas that are, for certain historical events. And, you know, what took place in that one town that dealt with, that there were Mexican-Americans that were living there. And, you know, the story was that some Rangers, and I don't know if they were all Rangers, if it was some Rangers, but they marched a group of men and boys out, and they claimed that there was a shootout. The evidence, based on what I'm reading, and I don't have any, I don't have primary sources, but they were saying that those guys were executed. But regardless, I wanted to get his take on it because he's going to tell us whether it was something that as bad as he says it was, or was it, that people just, fudge the information for an agenda? And he was like, yep, it really happened. And it's not something that there's no excuse for it. So I'm glad, I'm glad that he told us the story. But the reason why I was suspicious from the beginning was there was no mention of what all the raids that were taking place within Texas, starting with Pancho Villa, or at least he was involved in one of them.
Yeah, I mean, the situation had gotten completely out of control to the extent where you had the U.S. military involved, and including, sending General Pershing in. So obviously that's a situation that's gotten out of hand,
And it should be mentioned when you're talking about anything that took place during that time.
Yeah, and that's a moment that really doesn't get talked about, very, very much about that whole conflict with Mexico and the revolutionaries and the nationalists. So
I was going to mention when I took my recent trip, I went to Judge Roy Bean's courthouse, which is right on the border, right on the Texas-Mexican border. And I took some pictures and videos, which I will eventually post. But there was an area that if you walked further south from the courthouse and you get off the paved road and onto a gravel road, they call it like the Eagle's Nest. Now, I asked them, how far is the Eagle's Nest? And they said, well, don't go down there. They said, stay on the paved road, but where the gravel road takes you to the Eagle's Nest, don't go, because there's activity going on. It's dangerous over there. And so I stayed on the gravel road. I got out of my car and walked a little bit. But yeah, I didn't go any further because the border was right there. You could see Mexico. I mean, we're talking cliffs. It's not a flat area. It's high bluffs. And if there was someone like a sniper or somebody, easily they can take people out. But yeah, he was saying it's very dangerous down there.
Do you think that they were playing like illegal games of Dungeons and Dragons and stuff? What's going on down there?
I did see caves. I did take a picture of a couple of caves, cave entrances. So you never know. they could have, and I did see a horned lizard in that vicinity. So, there's your dragon. And I saw a roadrunner, too. I did see a roadrunner.
Well, there you go. Did you see a coyote?
I don't know if I saw a coyote. I don't know if I did. I did see deer. Yeah, I did see what looked like coyotes, but I think that was in New Mexico. I'm not exactly sure. But there's a lot of wildlife in that whole area.
So if you saw a roadrunner and you saw a cave and you didn't see a coyote, do you think possibly?
I saw Acme Bricks too.
I'm just throwing this out there. You know where I'm going.
Yeah, I know about the cave and the rocket and the.
Do you think the roadrunner just drew a cave, you know, for the coyote to run into and smash his face? All right. Well, there's my Looney Tune reference that I never get to do. Looney Tunes is my favorite. Oh, you know what? That's a good question, Alan. Who's your favorite Looney Tunes character?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I have a favorite. I had some that I didn't really, that really didn't, Foghorn Leghorn really didn't do much for me, but I loved Bugs Bunny. I loved Daffy Duck. I loved Speedy Gonzales, man. That guy was, you know, righteous. That was the Abominable Snowman, the one that called Porky George or Daffy George. I love him and hug him and call him George. Loved that guy. Roadrunner, loved the Roadrunner. You know,
well, I say now, I don't understand why you are not a fan of Foghorn Leghorn now.
Well, he just, you know, he was all right. Yosemite Sam was cool. Marvin the Martian, cool.
Yeah, but that's only because you're a Second Amendment advocate.
Well, what, Marvin the Martian? No, man.
No. Well, yeah, that too, because he's got the radar or the ray gun.
Yeah, he's got the Q36 space modulator, explosive space modulator.
So he is a great.
So
character.
He's got that. But Yosemite Sam, yeah. But you know, with Elmer Fudd, he's got the shotgun, kind of like what I have right here.
Yeah. Well, my favorite is Daffy Duck. Like it, and it's not even close. Like Daffy Duck is freaking hilarious.
Daffy Duck did rule.
Yeah. All right, well, that's it. That's all I got. You got anything else, man, before we skedaddle on out of here?
No, I was going to mention, if you ever get a chance, watch the Daffy Duck cartoons that came out during World War II, where he was making fun of Hitler and Goering and Goebbels. Yeah, you can find it on YouTube.
All right, I'll look for that.
Yep, Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny, both of them were used as World War II propaganda against both the Germans and the Japanese.
I like it. All right, man. Well, I will talk to you later. Hope you have a great week. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for watching the show, listening to the show, wherever it is that you're listening. Be sure to subscribe. I was going to say hello, but who are you going to say hello to? All right, see you later, everyone.
Why don't you say hello to my little friend?